where you were. We were talking about the...
About glucose monophosphate. And I thought it would be very interesting to compare the enzymatic with the non-enzymatic cleavage. I mean, I knew by that time that enzymes were highly specific. Mm-hmm. And so I figured it would go only one way with an enzyme. Well, I told Corey about this, and as you see, he was sufficiently interested to finance the construction of a mass spectrometer. That's the only way I could do this problem. Now, I did have the problem not only of building a mass spectrometer, but how do you get the oxygen out of phosphates? into the form of CO2. Okay. And I had to devise my own method of doing that.
Yeah, actually, in a way, it seemed to turn out simpler than most of the other methods.
Well, the disadvantage of the method that I devised, which was the dehydration of KH2PO4, and then
right.
is that you only got one oxygen out of the four this way.
So.
And presumably it was the average, which I think it was, but nevertheless, you had to use more material than you do with some of the other methods. Because then you had to have enough water to handle, you see. It isn't like going directly. Later I changed the method. I used the reduction of phosphate with carbon at something like 1300 degrees centigrade.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite a thing to devise a way of doing that. But I did use that because, first of all, I got all the oxygen, and secondly, I went immediately to the gas phase. It was carbon monoxide. That had a disadvantage that carbon monoxide has the same mass as nitrogen. And you had to be very careful never to have any air get in. I mean, you really had to work absolutely in good vacuum all throughout your handling of all this. So, and anyhow, this business of getting 1300 degrees or 1400 degrees centigrade and handling the stuff required a good deal of ingenuity. But I did use that method because I could then work with smaller quantities of material. But initially, that one that I hit on was easier to do, actually, than the later one that I devised.
Oh.
I mean, to dehydrate KH2PO4 was easy.
Mm-hmm.
You had to do it all in vacuum, of course, but you didn't have to go to very high temperatures to do it. I used to use a little flame, you know, a little burner to do it. And but then you had to...
And you had to exchange the water with the...
You had to get the CO2 in known amount and exchange the water and so on. But I had done that part on my thesis, yes. The water CO2 thing. So once I got water, I knew what to do with it.
But you must have gotten a great deal of satisfaction out of that particular problem, seeing as how that was...
Yes, it sort of had been in abeyance for 9 years. And I mean, this was something I had wanted to do even nine years earlier.
Right.
But it was all right. I didn't mind. I am very adaptable. I got quite interested in this transmethylation problem. It was a very interesting problem.
Yeah. Turned out a lot of work on that, too. For a short period, you were at the Harvard Medical School.
Oh, yeah, for 1 year.
And that was as a result of...
My husband was invited to MIT for a year. Vicky Weisskopf was going off to Europe to CERN or something, and they asked him to take his place.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just said no to a job he'd been offered at Carnegie Mellon, because there was nothing for me in Pittsburgh at the time. And so I felt very badly about that.
Yeah.
Now, was that Carnegie Mellon, that first one? Was that the one that Westinghouse? Westinghouse offered me a job. This thing came out of me. I've forgotten which job it was. It was also offered one at Carnegie Mellon. I can't remember the chronology exactly. But after visiting Pittsburgh and talking to Klaus Hoffman, who was at the University of Pittsburgh, whom I knew from Davinio's lab, Klaus said, there isn't a job for you now, but in a few years there will be. Well, I didn't want a hiatus of a few years. And Oh, I can't remember whether that was the Carnegie Mellon job or the Westinghouse that came first. If you're interested in one aspect of Corey, because that my husband was offered the job at Westinghouse in about 1948, 2 years after we were at Washington U. He wasn't even interested in going and looking at it. I said, why don't you go and look at it? Came back wildly enthusiastic. First of all, they had offered him double the salary he was getting at Washington University. And secondly, they told him he could do anything he liked. He didn't have to work on any company problems. They just wanted him for window dressing. Well, that sounded very attractive to him because he'd have all his time for research and he could do what he liked. So he told the chairman of his department, who was a very, very correct Englishman. And so he wrote a letter to the provost. And the provost had just recently before that come out with a policy that they would not react to outside offers. So a week or two later, Henry met this provost on the campus, and he said, nice to have known you, Mr. Primakoff. Henry came home and told me, so we were going to go to Pittsburgh, what could we do? So I went in and told Corey that we were leaving. He was just astounded. He said, why? So I told him the whole story. He said, do you want to go? I said, no, I don't want to go. So he said, Professor Hughes, that was the chairman of physics, never should have written a letter. He said, what could the guy do? He couldn't go back on his word. He said, he should have talked to him. He said, do you mind if I handle this? I said, not at all. So he called up Hughes, and the two of them went to see the provost. He said, rules, there are always exceptions to rules. So they both went, because the chairman of physics didn't want Henry to leave either, you understand. So they both went to see the provost, and they decided that Henry would get a raise, not a very big one, but he would get a raise. And another fellow who was a friend of ours who was in the physics department, who had come at the same time Henry had, would get a similar raise, though he had no outside offer. That made it okay as far as his principal was concerned. And to sweeten it, they're going to raise my salary, you see. So when I told Henry all this, or when his chairman informed him of it, Henry really, when he thought it over, really didn't want to go to work for Westinghouse, so we stayed. Then I felt badly about not... No, I don't know whether he was offered the Carnegie Mellon job before we went to Boston or not, but anyhow, it was because of one of these things that I thought, oh, well, I can't say no again, and so we went to Boston. And when I told Corey that I was going to Boston for a year, he said, I'll call Hastings. He was the chairman at Harvard, and so Hastings offered me a job for the year, for 9 months.
But he also let you do your own work.
Oh, yes, he let me, but he also paid me peanuts. I was shocked. And then I found out that the assistant professors weren't getting any more than I was.
Oh, well, he couldn't very well pay you more than he was paying as an assistant professor.
You know what an assistant professor in the medical school at Harvard was getting in 1950? I'll tell you what I was getting, and they weren't getting any more. $300 a month. So that year I earned $2,700 because I only worked 9 months. That was low even then. When I left the Vigneaux, I was going to be getting the next year $4,250. That was in 1946. I took less at Washington University, but not that much less. But $300 a month is low. And the assistant professors were getting no more than that. You were paid with prestige at Harvard.
You can't eat it, unfortunately.
No. Well, MIT, Henry was getting a good salary there, so it didn't matter.
Okay. The next paper you told me you thought was important was one that you had worked on partly at Harvard, and that was the oxidative phosphorylation.
That's right.
Tell me a little bit about that work and why you thought it was important for you. And
yeah, well, there was a very interesting man in the department in St. Louis, who told me in no uncertain terms that this work I was doing with O18, with these enzymatic reactions, it wasn't really very interesting because everyone knew what happened in those reactions. Actually, I should tell you that it was the glucose 1-phosphate thing was important because it showed that the reaction was a glycosyl or glucosyl transferring reaction rather than a phosphoryl transferring reaction, because the cleavage occurred between the C and the O. Anyhow, he said, what you want should do is go into completely uncharted waters and really attack a problem that nobody knows anything about. He said, like oxidative phosphorylation. So I thought about this for a while, and I thought, he's right.
Who was the guy who told you this?
His name was Graham Webster. He was a very imaginative man. Anyhow, I did an initial experiment at Washington University and found that something very exciting happened, that the phosphate exchange with water. Oh, sorry. Why don't I take this off and get it? Okay, can you hear me now? There was a man by the name of Ed Hunter in the pharmacology department who was working on oxidative phosphorylation. And so I went to him and I did the first experiment with his mitochondria. And it really was a very exciting result that in no enzymatic reaction had I ever seen an exchange of phosphate with water. Non-enzymatically, phosphate doesn't exchange with water until you go to 100 degrees and takes 7 days or something like that. And this was happening, of course, at room temperature and rather rapidly. So I realized that I had something interesting to follow up. And I remember before I left, I told Corey about it, and I said, I'm going to spend a year trying to figure out what's going on. And he said, good. If you do find out something, you'll make David Green with envy. David Green was the big shot in the field of oxidative phosphorylation. Anyhow, I got to Harvard, and I decided to pursue this problem. And I went to see, what is his name? I can't think of his name. Very good scientist who died young. He taught me how to make mitochondria. I'll think of his name after a while. And then the problem was I needed a mass spectrometer. And A.K. Solomon in the physiology department, he was a biophysicist, had a spectrometer of the same kind that I had, which, by the way, was later sold by Consolidated NIR, it was called, that instrument. Unfortunately, he didn't have it working the way I had it working, or as it was intended to be. It was a double receiver thing, so that you could get isotope ratios very accurately, because any variation affected both the same way, in the electron current, for example. But he didn't have it working that way, because he was investigating deuterium and hydrogen, and they're too far apart in mass to use this. So he used a single receiver only, and the other one they'd never gotten working. So I spent some time with his electronics man getting that thing to work. But finally I did get it to work. And I learned how to make mitochondria. When I came back to St. Louis, I remember telling Corey how proud I was of the fact that I had learned to make mitochondria that worked. And he just laughed. He said, here you are making mass spectrometers and so on, and you're proud of the fact that you can make mitochondria. That's all a matter of viewpoint, you see.
Yes, right. I mean, I guess if you'd always been making mass specs, you thought nothing about it.
But mitochondria was another thing, sure, because, in fact, they were difficult. It's interesting, the history of these things. The mitochondria were never really intact that were made in those days. And about 2 years later, everybody started making intact mitochondria. Everyone sort of made improvements and so on, and suddenly everybody's work. The trouble with the ones that weren't intact was that they broke down ATP, you see, and the ones that are intact don't. So anyhow, that's how I got started on that oxidative phosphorylation. And It is a fascinating problem, which I never solved, though I worked on it for quite a number of years. But the 018 effect there has, I worked on it for quite a while, and I did find out a number of things, but I never really found out how oxidative phosphorylation worked. But Paul Boyer out at UCLA has continued on this 018 phosphate exchange business, and he has gone much further, taken it much further than I ever did, and gotten some mechanistic information from it, particularly from the distribution of the four oxygens.
So he knows more about why the exchange is taking place so rapidly, or
well, what he knows, for example, is that depending on the distribution of the different species of 018, if you can fit that to a one process thing, you know that there's only one step in which this happens. But if it can't be fit at all by one, you know that there are two or more. For example, I'm giving you an example of the kind of thing he has found out from the distribution of the you know, the 4018, 3018, 2, and so on. The paper that really pleased me, though, was much later. That was here, where I found out that I could get analyze the 018 and phosphate by NMR. Yeah. I sort of brought together all the things I'd ever done, you see. And what's more, you got the distribution immediately. You have to kill yourself to get it chemically.
Yes.
So you can well imagine it's not an easy task. No. But here it was all spread out for you.
Yeah, so two of those, three of those papers that you starred for me, and I'll try to get back to those. In 1954, you published the first of a good many papers using PMR or ESR or
EPR.
You published this with Jonathan Townsend from the physics department at Washington.
Yes, he had constructed the instrument.
Okay, and he was on the faculty at the physics department.
Yeah,
and so how were you introduced to it?
Well, you see, I was interested in enzyme mechanisms by this time of kinases. I was still doing work on oxidative phosphorylation, but I was also doing work on transfer of phosphoryl groups, enzymatic transfer. And all of the reactions involving ATP require a divalent methyl ion. And the one that is usually of the natural activator is magnesium. And calcium often is an inhibitor, though sometimes it's an activator, but calcium sometimes can substitute for magnesium, but often not. Manganese always can. I remember asking Sam Weissman, who was a physical chemist whom I talked to quite a bit, I said, Sam, what makes magnesium and manganese the same? He said, they both start with the letter M. But the fact is that they aren't so different in size, and calcium and magnesium are very different in size, and there are other properties that differ. Manganese does work, and I know that manganese was paramagnetic. Did I tell you that I had once done some magnetochemistry while I was with Vigneault?
No.
I was always fascinated by it. I had read Pauling's papers on hemoglobin, which he published in 1936, where he had, using magnetic susceptibility, static magnetic susceptibility measurements, found out what the valence state was of the iron in hemoglobin, in methemoglobin, and other derivatives. I thought that was neat. Now, one of the things that Vigneault worked on was the structure of insulin. It has sulfur amino acids in it, of course. Everything he touched always had sulfur amino acids. These peptides that he worked with did. Anyhow, I went to him and told him my idea that, you see, insulin is crystallized with zinc, but it also crystallizes with cobalt and with nickel, and cadmium, I think. Well, cobalt and nickel, of course, are paramagnetic. So I went to him and I said, look, I think I have a way of determining what the valence state of cobalt or nickel is in insulin. And he said, go to it, go ahead and do it. So I went up to Columbia, where I knew Iskandarian. He was a physicist who had gotten his PhD just about the time I had, on the magnetic properties of D2O versus H2O, the static susceptibility measurements he had made. He had an exquisitely sensitive instrument for measuring magnetic susceptibility. It was so sensitive that you could only work on it after midnight, because it was in the physics building, and you know that's on right near 120th Street, and the trucks that went by during the day were enough to make it impossible to use the instrument. So I did this. I used to go at midnight to start the measurements. Anyhow, I did this. It was not successful for the simple reason that with static susceptibility, it's the difference between the paramagnetic contribution and the diamagnetic contribution. And in a protein, that diamagnetic contribution is tremendous. So that to decide whether cobalt-2 or cobalt-3 is involved is not easy. It was the difference between two big numbers, and that number I had to decide whether it was due to 2 or 3. And so I gave up. It was not a sensitive enough method for a paramagnetic ion in a protein. However, when I heard about EPR, I said, this is the method, because here you're not worried by the diamagnetic contribution. You only see the paramagnetic ion. And by this time, I was no longer interested in insulin, but I was interested in these kinases, which were catalyzed, had an obligatory requirement for dimethylmetal ion. So that's why I started on the manganese. Mm-hmm. Now, I was very disappointed, because when I put a protein in there, the signal disappeared.
Of course, that was helpful in that first experiment.
I made a good thing out of my negative result. Yes.
Right. Okay.
But it didn't help me to look at manganese on the protein.
In each and every one of your papers, you would mention this fact that it disappears until you finally did reach one paper where you managed it.
Well, when I figured out, on my postdoc, figured out how to see it.
Yeah.
Then I turned to molybdenum, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I came to work to publish that paper with Sam Weissman on the molybdocyanine, you see. Because there are a number of enzymes that are molybdenum catalyzed.
Oh, okay.
Or the enzymes have molybdenum in them. Xanthine oxidase is one, but anyhow, there are several of them. And I thought, well, I can't get anywhere with manganese proteins. Let's see what happens with molybdenum proteins. But I tried molybdenum chloride first, just to see what the molybdenum spectrum looked like, and I got no signal. So I then went to the literature and found out that Simon Fried, who was, by the way, the mentor of both Sam Weissman and Harry Thode, they both got their degrees with Simon Fried at the University of Chicago, had a paper where he showed that the molybdenum chloride was a dimer and therefore had no paramagnetism, you see. And so I looked through the literature to find something which didn't do that, and I came across this molybdocyanine. I want to use it just as a model compound to see what the molybdenum spectrum looked like.
Right.
And so I did. I had to prepare the molybdocyanine myself. You can't buy that. So I made it, and I looked at it, and sure enough, I got a beautiful spectrum. Well, then I started playing with some of these molybdenum proteins, and they were too difficult to work with. They were all light sensitive. And so at that point, I stopped doing EPR altogether and went to NMR.
Did you... did some experiments with a series of isotopes in the molybdenum paper.
Oh, yes. I didn't do that. Sam did that. You see, I got this remarkable spectrum of this molybdenum cyanide. First of all, there are two isotopes of molybdenum, and they both there. And one could tell what the spin was because it was a spin of 7 halves because of the number of peaks that I got. And Sam got all excited about this, and he said, I don't think that's even known. You've just discovered what the spin is. He went to the literature and found that just that month someone had determined it by another method. Mm-hmm. And there was a satellite peak next to every peak in that thing. Mm-hmm. I showed it to Sam. He said, I don't know what it is. So we went to George Paik. George Paik was the guru of EPR at that time. He was in the physics department.
It's
P-A-K-E. He wrote a little book, I think, on EPR. But anyhow, we went to George, and George looked at it and said, experimental artifact. So I dropped it. About 3 or 4 months later, Sam Weissman called me and said, Mildred, I think I know what those satellite peaks are due to. I think it's due to carbon-13 and nitrogen-15. He said, where did you get that molybdenum cyanide? I said, I made it. And I think that's when he first realized that I was a chemist, not just a biochemist. Because it was an inorganic compound after all. So he wanted to know how to make it. I told him what the method was. And he got some C13 cyanide, you see. And he made the compound. And then he got that fantastic spectrum. And the reason is, and so he wrote it up as a note, a page, I think, in the Journal of Chemical Physics. And it's in this book of on transition elements by, what is his name, the man who's turned to the study of the evolution of life, the origin of life. He was a transition element inorganic chemist at that time. He's out at the Salk Institute now. An Englishman.
Oh, I was thinking of the fellow who worked with Urey, but...
Oh, no, not him. No. This is an Englishman who worked on transition metals, and he's written a little book on it. And he wrote that book after this piece of work was done. And he pointed out it was the first direct evidence that there was orbital overlap between a ligand and a metal ion.
This isn't stones.
No. My memory for names is getting bad. Why do I think
I'm really
of
worried.
Huh?
I'm really worried. My name, my recognition is gone already.
Really?
That's absolutely terrible.
Yeah, well.